You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 27th of October 2012 here on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. A design bulletin from the Dutch, something for the shooting and angling set, a gentleman with an eye for a tight grid, and an editor with a command of large format print. All that, plus the Germans are coming, ahead on episode 9 of The Stack. We'll be heading to Berlin and leafing through the pages of a brand new magazine offering a more confident and assertive take on Germany. Worry not, there are no armbands or shiny boots.
We are proud of ourselves, something that's still hard to speak out loud over here. So these are the thoughts behind the English titles of Germans.
And we find out how a Beirut-based magazine is hoping the power of print can help spur a cultural renaissance in the Middle East.
The magazine was conceived to ignite a socio-cultural renaissance in the Middle East, not only in Lebanon.
All that, plus a few reading tips, live from Studio One here at Midori House on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Edition 9 of The Stack, our weekly roundup of the best in paper, perfect binding, and spot varnishes here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé. It should be a relaxing Saturday here at Midori House, but instead there are scores of editors, subs, and designers working away just above our heads on our biggest issue ever. Fortunately, I'm in the safe surrounds of Studio One for the moment, but will soon jump upstairs to help out the rest put the beast to bed. Before that, though, we have a busy 50 minutes or so ahead of us on The Stack, so let's see who's around the table today. Well, our first guest had a bit of a hairy journey. The Bakerloo line, for anyone who's listening right now, is causing problems on a Saturday morning here in London. After studying physics at King's College in London, he went on to perform in the 1980s band Landscape. He's since spent time working for the Architectural Review and is now editor of The Eye, a quarterly magazine on graphic design and beautiful grids. John Walters, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to hear first about the transition pop group to then sitting in an editor's chair.
It's never seemed that different to me because as initially a band leader and a composer, always kind of organizing, putting creative people together in different ways. And then after my 15 minutes of pop fame, I became a record producer. And again, you know, when you're a record producer, you're sitting in front of a computer dealing with lots of fragile egos and people with interesting points of view. And being, as you know very well, being an editor is quite similar to that.
And where does where does the eye sit in the landscape grid at the moment, would you say?
Because the grid is all important. You're quite right. Yes. As long as you have a grid, the typeface...
Everything's going to be safe.
The typeface changes with each issue we do, which is a little challenge that Simon Esterson, business partner and the art director of I, set him, as if life wasn't difficult enough, set himself the challenge of changing the typeface with each issue. So what remains, what makes I look like I, is the grid, the template. Mm.
Great. We're also joined by Charlotte Ray, co-editor of the Acme paper, the award-winning biannual fashion and culture magazine published by the Stockholm-based fashion label Acne. It's made a name for itself by bucking the trend through in-depth interviews and rather nostalgic art direction. Charlotte, good morning, welcome.
Good morning, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about it, because the first time it came out, I thought, amazing, fantastic. And then the second time, I thought, really well done. They've sustained it. It wasn't a one-off. And, you know, now you're churning it out properly, which is great. Why the commitment on the part of the owners to invest in something like this? Because we've seen so many people, you know, just, again, they're often sort of vanity exercises that never sustain themselves, or everyone moves on to doing something digital, or they just want to do an ad campaign.
Well, I think that's really in the brand DNA, because Acne started as a creative collective. So the magazine and the books that we're currently working on are the publishing branch of the brand. So the magazine really sort of adds to that circle of creativity that the brand really that is at the center of the brand.
Mm. We have the new issue here. You've done a split cover run as well, correct?
Yeah.
So we have. I'm looking at Manhattan Portraits, and a beautiful shot by Brigitte Lacombe of Fran Lebowitz, just looking absolutely amazing. And just in terms of, you know, uptake and I guess sort of an editorial point of view, what are you trying to achieve every issue? Because there has also been an evolution as well. You haven't been static. And the great thing is you haven't cut your trim size. You're still committed to doing something big and luscious. But from an editorial perspective, what are you trying to do every month? Or twice a year, I should say.
I think that we try to capture the best of the theme that we've chosen for each magazine or for each issue. So this one with Manhattan, we really sort of wanted to capture the spirit of the Manhattan that we feel that when we arrive on the island and all the people that we meet there.
Right. We're going to start off today just with a little story. We're going to go jump over to the continent. And I want you to reflect on a title I'm going to just put under your noses for the moment while I read this wee bit of script. Because earlier in the week, a new magazine landed on kiosks across the Federal Republic of Germany. The Germans is a perfect-bound, handsomely designed celebration of all things Deutschland. Based in Berlin and priced at €4.80, The Germans enters a very competitive magazine market as an unapologetic print edition full of optimism, ideas, and a subtle bit of swagger. As Europe's biggest economy continues to push forward with its own ideas about nation building and fiscal management, I asked editor Nicole Zepter what The Germans is all about. The title begs the question, why the Germans? This is a German language magazine. All of your cover lines are written in German, but yet you've gone for an English masthead. And I mean, you could have been Die Deutsche, you could have been something else. Were you trying to be slightly ironic? What was the thinking behind this?
To tell you the truth, Die Deutsche, I wouldn't dare to call the magazine Die Deutschen, because it sounds really right-wing, conservative, and even reminds me of nationalism and World War II. So it's a difficult topic here in Germany. But the Germans, the English title, intends to change this view because it's also a statement, because it's still close to Die Deutschen. So maybe, I don't know, it's a synonym for a new modern global view, global perspective. We focus on German topics and also believe that we need a bit more confidence to say that we are proud of ourselves, something that's still hard to speak out loud over here. So these are the thoughts behind the English title, The Germans.
Now, when you talk about being more confident, this is very interesting, because this is a theme which I'm hearing a lot whenever I dip into Germany, whenever I'm speaking to other German journalists, friends, colleagues, etc. I get this sense over even the last 24 months that Germans, you know, want to be recognized for all the good that they are doing in Europe. You know, let's put Greece to one side for a moment, or what the view from Athens is. But you know, Germans really feel that, you know, they've done everything right because of the good side of conservatism in the country, that they've been, you know, very astute. They've stuck with manufacturing. There's been an investment in having a culture of the Praktikant, the apprentice. You know, all of these things have come good for Germany. So within the covers of the Germans, is there a lot of soul searching going on? Because oftentimes this is what we see when we see big German journals, a lot of questions and digging deep into the German soul. Or is the Germans, from an editorial point of view, marching forward? What are the key topics you're talking about in your launch issue?
So I would say we're not trying to soul search. We're more speaking about the change, because we're living in a change. Mainly topics are like the rays of new times. This is our title topic in the first launch issue. And this is based on our concept, you know, that we wanted to be a young, new voice, a bold voice, next to the Spiegel, Die Zeit, Stern and Focus. And proclaiming it with this title, there are new times rising. So this is basically our title topic.
The last time I was in Berlin, we were talking to some of your other colleagues from the journalistic fraternity, not just in Berlin, but also in Hamburg as well. And it was very interesting to hear from other editors that they felt that Germany has not done anything wrong in this current economy. It is showing a level of stewardship and leadership, not just within the European stage, but also globally. And there is this real sense that Germans should be proud. And maybe we're at the point now where we're well into the second decade decade of a new century, and you know, Germans should be able to fly their flag at this point. Where do you think this sense comes from? And again, you almost feel it's a little bit wrong to talk about German nationalism, but I got the sense when you speak to young journalists and Germans in general that they feel that maybe the time has come to stand up and be noticed.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. That was basically the idea about or that we had in our mind when we created the Germans, because you cannot really say what it is, but you can feel it that there is, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, I thought that the world and especially Germany changed so drastically that we need a new voice. So we created the Germans, and we needed a young voice, a bold voice, and a progressive voice, because you know, the Spiegel and Die Zeit are no doubt very good publications, but do they really speak my language and share my perspective? I don't think so. They are not as bold as we are, maybe, because they cannot. So I cannot really explain it, but we just feel it. There are so many things to talk about in a new progressive way.
Now, what gap do you think you fill in the market beyond an ideological one, as you're saying that that you want to have this confident voice? But if we look at the German kiosk, it's incredibly dense. There are so many journals from think tanks. There is still a very strong culture. I mean, you mentioned Der Spiegel. There's still a very strong culture of the Newsweekly, also with Stern, also with Focus. You've got Die Zeit as well. So what type of channel do you see yourself carving in the marketplace?
Well, I think on the one hand, the news titles, from my perspective, will be online in, I don't know, 10 years or so. But for us, because we printed a magazine and not started a blog, we believe that we can cover current affairs with background information. And there is maybe a gap for urban creative class. I don't know, but this might be our target group.
It's interesting that you say that. And I want to go back to your point that this, you decided to start in print rather than going directly online. Of course, you have a website. You know, this could have been a blog, a celebration of all things that are wonderful in German. You have a cover story, Was jetzt glücklich macht, 25 Ideen aus Deutschland. So what makes you happy, 25, you know, ideas out of Germany, which is, again, it's just this interesting, you know, confident expression. But I'll go back to the question, though. Why a magazine first, as opposed to just being digital?
Because personally, I think print has still a bigger impact branding-wise. You have a bigger coverage. And I think it's the branding effect for the publication like the Germans. It's much easier to have something in your hand for a new reader than to see us online. And also, I love print. I love paper. I love to read on the sofa and hold my magazine instead of an iPad. The Germans is a media idea. And I just thought we have to start branding-wise on paper.
And that was the editor of The Germans, Nicole Zepter. Charlotte, would we ever see a magazine, you're Swedish, would we ever see something called The Swedes? I mean, we've had Stockholm New in the past and things like that. But did you think you would ever see an expression the same way, maybe coming out of Sweden like that?
Yes, I think that's possible. I think that would be really interesting. I was reading the A.A. Gill article in Vanity Fair on his trip to Scandinavia and his impressions. So I think that would sort of be a continuation of that, which I think would be quite interesting.
And you don't think it would perhaps raise any questions in a very liberal society like Sweden, where the Swedes are often, you know, very shy about even national holidays and things like that. You're allowed to sort of wave the flag during sporting events and maybe Eurovision. Do you think it would sort of raise any questions, though, like we were asking Nicole about issues of nationalism and being seen to be too right wing?
No, I think people would see it quite humorously, obviously depending on the content of the magazine. But no, I think they would be quite open to read something that is sort of an analysis of Sweden and Swedes.
Mm. What was your take on it when you looked through? Because I love the fact that, you know, just that when I was asking earlier on, why isn't it Die Deutsche, for example? And, you know, she said, you know, in so many ways, and we were also talking offline, she said, you know, it's just because, you know, the way that, you know, the Brits talk about the Germans. and they said that's why they felt they had a bit of license to get away with it.
It looks very confident. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how it develops. And the 25 things that make you happy is a kind of one of those classic print magazine devices, isn't it? And it's very nicely laid out with some great photography.
Yeah, I think as a launch beginning, because it also rides a tricky balance between not looking overly artistic. It feels quite commercial in a way, in that sort of choice of paper and everything. But then I think from a design point of view, it has the feeling of more of sort of a lovely journal. So I think that's a very tricky balance to hit on a launch issue as well.
I think there's something very satisfying about that kind of chunky news magazine format.
Mm.
That we're just seeing Newsweek give it up.
Yes, so indeed.
Maybe there's room for some well-designed magazines to fill that gap.
Yeah, this is a topic that we were exploring last week, and I think we'll be talking a lot about Newsweek over the weeks to come. There is a ton of print around us today, so we're going to go away for a very short break. We're going to let all of you get on with your magazines in a moment. You're listening to The Stack. We're back in a moment.
A careful attention to detail helps define the clothing that J.Crew makes. As head menswear designer Frank Mouchens explains, creating the best products often means approaching the design process through an unconventional lens, bringing together the best materials in the world with bold, smart designs.
To us, it's always striving for the best. It's about fit and design and color and fabric, and about working with the best mills and factories in the world. And in men's, you have to be persistent and consistent. All these values get translated by being obsessive about details, whether it's replicating a cool vintage button for a work shirt or shaping the armhole of our Ludlow jacket. So we question all components of a garment, and even the amount of stitches per inch can make a huge difference.
J.Crew.
Second Cycle is a special kind of upscaling that understands consumers' connection to objects with a personal history. Monocle Films traveled to Helsinki to watch Finnish furniture brand Artek hunt down old items and bring them back to life.
It was quite an emotional thing for all of us. When we went through the flea markets and schools and kindergarten from where we bought these things, we took them to our office and our employees started to say that, Mirko, don't do anything to them. Don't touch them, don't hurt them. Let them be as they are.
You can watch this Second Cycle film and many more films in the program's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to The Stack here on a Saturday morning in London. A very crisp, rather beautiful, sunny Saturday that we are having. We are joined by Charlotte Reyes, the co-editor of the Acne paper, and also John Walters, who is the editor of The Eye. Now, Charlotte, I want to start with you because, curiously, you brought in, I see you've got Lapham's Quarterly sitting there. We were in Toronto last week, and that was sitting on The Stack in Toronto. We never got around to it. So why did you bring it in?
Because I really like the way how they've edited text from historical, this one particularly is on the future, and they have chosen texts throughout history by representatives in literature, in philosophy, psychology, that have had thoughts on the future. Mm. And I think that's an incredible way of sort of informing and building context.
Now, for those who aren't familiar with Lapham's Quarterly, just describe what you're feeling, the actual physical form of it. It's very book-like.
It's very book-like. It's quite heavy. It's very text-based. It will take a while to get through. It has a few images in it, both photography and paintings, illustrations, prints. It is almost like an encyclopedia on a subject. The paper is quite matte, sort of waxy on the outside. The pages within it, it's a little bit heavier than normal. It's really lovely.
John, do you think that we're moving to a position where people want more of a value-based proposition? I think we see so many new journals come out at the moment that there is this rather sort of journal-like form that they take on, and also we've seen, you know, with frequencies, even talking about acne. I mean, you know, this big twice yearly volume that comes out. You're on a quarterly frequency. That do we need more hooks? I guess what I'm getting at in print than we did before.
Well, it's beginning to seem like we're in it's beginning to seem as if we're in a golden age of magazines, because the web has kind of liberated the print magazine.
Liberated or just forced them to up their game?
Well, maybe a bit of both, you know, and it's forced a few of them to stop publishing altogether, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
And I think the book-like magazine, which I guess I is sometimes described as being book-like, although we are still a sort of, you know, quite a large format, it means you can concentrate on values that people enjoy when they're reading something. You can spend a bit of time reading, but I think there's also a place for the more, you know, the newsprint printed magazine and the weekly format that we're talking about, a London Review of Books, which I brought along. There's actually a lot of scope on the newsstand if, you know, the more imaginative bookshops and newsstands are really delighting in this. You know, almost in any major city now, you can go into a really good bookshop that has a whole wall or maybe two or three walls covered in interesting magazines, and you always find something you didn't know about.
You mentioned something, newsprint, and maybe a faster form of publishing, and I think you've got a room over there. Yes, that one.
Vroom's an interesting case study because it started out as a perfect bound glossy, comparable to I, really, in its production values, using quite heavy paper, mixer papers.
Now, tell us a bit about the background of Varum.
Well, it's actually the house journal of the Association of Illustrators, so it goes out to their members, but it's also available on the newsstand.
And UK-based?
It's based in the UK. The Association of Illustrators is a long-lived trade association, I guess, for illustrators, and they have conferences. I went down to Somerset House the other day to see a very interesting one-day seminar on the sentimental gene, which could almost be another program here.
So
what you get is a big roundup of writing about illustration. For example, Martin Collier, the art director, and actually like me, a former pop musician, interviews John Pash, who designed the Rolling Stones Lips and Tongue logo more than 40 years ago, and it's still going strong. It's just been redesigned by Shepard Fairey.
And I'm trying to look for the frequency on this.
I think it's
autumn. Maybe it's quarterly.
It's an autumn issue. Yeah.
It's interesting that form is also chosen for something which, you know, is dropping to people's letterboxes as well. But, you know, going back to that sort of note of upping, you know, people having to up their game, I think there is, you know, I think really an issue of also trying to just challenge people, I think, constantly as well. You know, we do not think that. Yeah, just when you thought you're maybe going to get a very, you know, I often think of when you get illustration portfolios, you get these like, cute little books which have sort of, you know, people's spot illos on them. But then you get this kind of quite disposable newspaper.
Yes, although I think that's, Varum is something you would want to keep.
No, absolutely.
A lot of good writing. But I think it also means you can just stick it in your bag when you're on the train in a way that you might not do with a more... some of the magazines Charlotte's brought along, like Visionaire, that's not really something you stick in your pocket when you're going up to Manchester.
No, Charlotte, you've got, a considerable stack over there. And I see that you've got, I think, an old copy of Visionaire. Now, did you bring that in from everything? I don't want to say they all completely mirror the size and scale of Acne, but you brought those more sort of points of inspiration, or these things that you also look to. Where you're sort of thinking about a next issue, not of course that you're copying them, but certainly as a jumping off point, maybe.
Yeah, in a way, I think that they sort of belong within the sort of style bible and / fashion object industry, where Acne paper also fits in as something that you treasure, something that you collect, just as John said, not something that you bring on the train to Manchester easily, but something that you're sort of proud to have around and something that you also keep and refer to for inspiration. more like a book.
How much do you discuss, or is there any dialogue between the London, Paris, Stockholm offices of your magazine about frequency? And I ask this because we see how fast fashion moves today, and even let's say, of course, the fashion side of your business is not just associated with two collections a year anymore. So is there ever sort of a discussion that there should be a quarterly, that you should go quarterly potentially, or are you pretty fixed that, you know, people really look forward to getting this just twice a year and that's part of the magic of it?
I think it's part of the magic of it. I think twice a year is a quite perfect frequency. You have the fall issue and you have the spring summer issue. And yes, of course, it sort of mirrors the traditional way of how you launch fashion collections, although it doesn't really work like that anymore with resort, etc. But I think that's a good frequency. And we've also found that people really, really look forward to it and really anticipate it. And also, it's a big publication. I think quarterly would almost not really give people enough time to sort of have a proper read through it.
Mm. When you sit down to edit it, do you think of people really looking at it and discovering it through multiple sittings? And I know when I have it, you know, sitting on my coffee table at home, it's, you know, it's something you refer to again and again. You go back and I think that's what's interesting, because sometimes I feel we've been conditioned that, you know, we're supposed to consume everything. I'm just looking at this screen in front of me that, you know, you're supposed to read everything in one hit because it's there in 40 lines for you. But, you know, that's the wonderful thing about these journals, is that they can sit there and they can linger and you can go back again.
I mean, we have, for example, I mean, the magazine is based around a timeless theme. So the idea is that you will always be able to refer back to anything within. But what's amazing is that we've found is that people who are interested in the magazine and who pick it up, they come back for back issues so often, because they understand that it's not only about the articles, it's sort of more like a frame of mind.
Yeah.
And also the visuals in it is something that's timeless. And also, since we draw not only from new things, it's just a really lovely way to present something, and therefore people come back to it rather than sort of Google it in a way.
Well, go ahead, John.
Yeah, so that's the beauty of the themed magazine, that it's timely, but it's also timeless. And then if you do a theme on a big subject, say like Berlin or Brand Madness, which we've done in then people will go back and buy those back issues. And that's become quite an important part of our business model, in fact.
Ours too. We were laughing on the editorial floor yesterday because I got this wonderful note from a gentleman who said that he was furious with his removals company because he'd lost issues. They had lost issues 1 to 43 of Monocle. So he said, you know, is there just any way that would I be able to get all 43 of them? He said, you know, my checkbook's at the ready. I need to have them. And again, I think when you talk to media companies today, when you speak to other, you know, I feel when I speak to other CEOs, et cetera, they just think, oh God, we've got all of these, you know, magazines sitting in a warehouse. We should just get rid of all of them and we can just, you know, digitally archive all of it. But yet, you know, there is that, you know, that enormous sense of value that people, you know, want to feel that they've got the complete collection.
Well,
and they're able to reference it. I can actually see it. It's there. It's tangible. It's on the shelf.
Of course, the beauty of a digital archive is that you can find things in your physical archive much more easily.
Yes.
So, they work together beautifully. I mean, I remember, you know, when I worked on the Architectural Review, the thing of compiling the index was a sort of massive chore and a print thing. In fact, I seem to remember no one really wanted to get too involved in that. And then, you know, the readers...
The job for the interns.
But, of course, when all that's online, you can just find out that, you know, the particular article you're looking for was issue 54 and then track it down.
Now, you said you've got Frieze Masters, we were covering, of course, the Frieze Art Fair and also Masters being a new element that they launched this
year. Art before 2000.
Exactly.
It's the old stuff.
Yeah. So
it's a rather beautifully designed by Sonia Dykova, who's the new designer of Frieze magazine. It's edited by Jennifer Higgy. And I presume it's an annual thing. I haven't really had much time to read it, but it's very beautifully put together with, of course, fantastic source material. An interesting little rhyme with the Germans, which we just looked at, which is the use of big numbers. Find your way through the navigation of a piece called Notes on the Studio.
It's Just looking at it from afar, it's very beautifully done. Did this pop through your letterbox, or did you pick it up on the newsstand this morning?
I just got it through letterbox last night.
Now it's again, this is just something. Of course, art. Art from the new master series is something that will continue to sort of live on and live on, and people have no trouble wanting to hold on to that.
You could argue that it is more like a book or a catalogue, but of course it works in the same way as a magazine with advertising, and has a kind of it has the qualities of Frieze, but in a way it's probably pointed at a slightly different audience.
Mm. I'm going to draw your attention to a copy of the magazine, The Outpost, there, which you can look at as we zip away for a short break. You're listening to The Stack. When we come back, we're going to be talking to the editor-in-chief of The Outpost. Back in a moment.
J. Crew's designers are constantly pushing boundaries with hopes of making the best clothing available today. As head menswear designer Frank Malchin says, every garment J. Crew produces requires attention to detail, meaning the little things are as important as the most obvious.
We don't leave a stone unturned, like every detail is important to us. Every component of a garment gets a lot of attention, different button shapes, everything, like even stitches per inch is important to us, and for an outsider it might not look like something, but even the stitch color is important. Like all those little things people sometimes take for granted, and people maybe don't realize that there's a thought process behind that as well.
J. Crew. The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we sip some wines in Missouri, we discover how the raw food trend is gradually taking over Berlin, and we meet one of New York's top chefs, April Bloomfield.
You've got the best produce and you're just kind of letting it speak for itself. But it's kind of put on the plate in a way that looks beautiful and airy, because you kind of eat with your eyes too.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House in London. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Well, Beirut-based magazine The Outpost has some lofty ambitions. Its editor believes that print has the power to help kick off a cultural renaissance in the region. Born of a frustration with the glossy, cheap titles typical of the Middle East, and with a view that the digital world didn't offer the same authority, Ibrahim Neme launched The Outpost in September of last year. Earlier this week, our editor Andrew Tuck spoke to Neme about why he's putting his faith in the printed word.
So Ibrahim, I have a copy of your magazine here in my hand, a nice glossy covered magazine with nice kind of newsprint style paper inside. It's a magazine that seems to have something quite powerful at its heart, a desire to kind of change how Lebanon sees itself and how Beirut is being built. What's the force behind this magazine?
Well, as mentioned in the opening editorial of our inaugural issue, the magazine was conceived to ignite a socio-cultural renaissance in the Middle East, not only in Lebanon. We really believe in the print medium and really believe in the power of the story to inspire a reader.
So you're trying to look for social change in the Arab world, and you're trying to represent that in your pages?
Absolutely. Especially in these times when the Arab world is changing significantly. Not only politically, I mean the social and cultural changes are immense. And there are so many stories that are not being told in the media outlets, be it print or mass media, which we aim to cover and report on.
Now, what's interesting is that there sounds to be some frustration at the heart of this magazine. For example, one of the things that you talk about is the rebuilding of Beirut, and the fact that you feel that Many people are being pushed aside in the debate about what happens to your city. Now, I know you're looking beyond Beirut, but this is a good example because you're reimagining the city in the pages of this inaugural issue of the magazine. Do you think that that people in Beirut are not being included in the social discussion? Do you think that's the same throughout the Arab world?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a social and a political system that just doesn't work, be it in Lebanon or in the rest of the Arab world. And these frustrations, the frustrations of the young adults who live here, who want to actually change their countries, change their realities, is manifested in the different movements that are springing up in the region.
Now, it's interesting that much of that kind of social change that you're referencing, the Arab Spring, as it's known in many quarters, that actually happened, many people feel, in part triggered by what was happening in social media. But you've not chosen to go into that online space, really. You're quite keen on the power of print. Why is that?
I think I'm a big fan of print to start with. And I think as the internet is turning into this junkyard of information, and I think the reader is in dire need for sources that can actually sift through this immense amount of data and stories and filter it, package it in a nice way, and deliver it across different mediums, not necessarily in print, but I still think that the print retains an immense power to inspire and even entertain.
Now, what's interesting is, you know, you've certainly used the print format. You have a little pull-out booklet, you've used different paper stocks. Was it interesting trying to pull this together in Beirut? Is Beirut a good place to print a magazine these days?
Not really. Actually, we've had so much problems to put this magazine together, be it to convince people about the concept of our brand, or to pool in resources to actually produce a magazine of this caliber. And printing the publication was one of the problems. As you see, we have an insert in the inside, a supplement inside the magazine, and it was really hard to actually try to crack the logistical framework of how to go about this. It's not easy, and even in terms of the maturity of the market, for the longest time, the Lebanese market, or even the Arab market, has been flooded with glossy, cheap titles. And I think it's about time that we push the bar of magazine production in the Middle East, because it's really very pathetic.
Now, I was travelling in the Gulf only like a couple of weeks ago for Monocle, and what was interesting there is there's very little proper newsstand sales going on in the region. Is it difficult for you producing a magazine that's aimed at the Arab world? What is the format of kind of getting it into people's hands? Maybe there's more newsstands actually in Beirut than there is, say, in Doha, but is it quite difficult actually just to get the magazine in front of people?
It is. It's very difficult in the sense that, as I said, it boils back to the immaturity of the market. Even the salespeople who are in the bookshops responsible for selling the magazines, they don't really understand how to actually display the magazine, where to display it. And we're still trying actually to sort out our distribution problems.
I'm afraid I can tell you that even when you work for a magazine that sits in London, you find yourself, wherever you are in the world, moving your magazine to the correct section of the magazine stand. So I agree it's probably more sharper a problem for you, but it's certainly a global problem. At the moment, where is the magazine on sale?
So far in Lebanon, in Jordan and in Egypt. We're trying to get it into the UAE because these are the four key markets in the Arab world. By end of the year, we hope that it will be available in major cities across Europe. And we're starting our subscriptions with our December issue. So far, it's only available online. Like you can buy it online if you're abroad.
Now, Ibrahim, the magazine's called The Outpost. Why did you choose that name?
The Outpost is this remote area that's used for scanning and surveilling from possible attacks. Usually the military takes an outpost in specific remote area that's far from where their initial camp is based. The inquisitive and the investigative connotations of the name to that end were there, and we felt that the connotations were very journalistic. And because we're a magazine of possibilities, we also felt that being this remote place or this remote area is an interesting place where possibilities can happen.
And could you just tell me, so the magazine, are you going to produce it monthly?
It's a quarterly magazine, and it's backed up by a digital platform which hosts a weekly audio show.
And that was Ibrahim Neme, editor-in-chief of The Outpost. And just in the introduction, I said that they had launched last September, but it was this September. They just launched a month ago. Give that editor, I would say bigger platform. Very, very interesting. I loved his description of how he saw The Outpost as well. John, what did you think of it as you were flipping through what we're listening to?
Well, from a quick flip, it looks very impressive. A lot of care and craft has gone into making a rather beautiful magazine. And but of course, the proof is always in, can you keep that up over the issues? I was also impressed by the use of infographics. Mm. I think they've obviously been keeping an eye on Richard Turley's art direction for Bloomberg Business Week, which is really up the game for infographics that are both entertaining and on a sort of, more higher frequency news level, but also informative and usually have a bit of attitude about them. And here there's a feature with a great title of Negotiating Happiness: Social Progress Beyond Economic Indicators.
Mm.
And also a nice little piece about, which talks about, what would society look like if more people started dancing?
That's also curious as well, because did you see in the top 25 things to make you happy in the Germans, Tanzen was also one of them. Dancing is also makes you happy.
Everything connects.
Now, it's always difficult to judge an issue on its first issue, but of course everybody does. Charlotte, what do you make of it?
I think it's really, really lovely use of paper. The paper is really silky and really nice. What I really also like, what you're saying about the graphics, is that it's very tonal. Hmm. It's very sort of deep, mature colors, which is really nice. And the photography is lovely, and also the sort of balance on the pages between the different typefaces. I think it's lovely.
Good. Well, I think we've made Ibrahim Neme, the editor of Outpost Morning. If you're sitting listening in Beirut, looks like it's a two thumbs up. You're listening to The Stack. We're back in a moment to go through what's left around the table and the stools in the studio. And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 on a very sunny Saturday morning here in London. Now, I brought, in the intro, we're talking about Items magazine, a Dutch-based title. This focusing, of course, on graduate Dutch design. The Dutch knowing a thing or two about good graphics in general and some very fine print. And you're holding it delicately there, John.
So that Charlotte can see it properly. Well, Items has really had a renaissance, I think. And in a way, their story mirrors that of Eyes, because the editor of Items, Max Brownsma, who was the editor of Eye a long time ago, has become the owner. There's been a management buyout, and it looks very confident and beautifully designed, as you would expect from a Dutch design practice.
Mm.
It's not just a graphic design magazine, however. It covers product design, and I think it may cover architecture and other issues. But this is the first issue I've seen for a while, and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think I like this idea that it's comprehensive and it's a one-stop shop. And this, certainly looking at all of the graduate projects that have come out of the Netherlands as well, and I think this is having that type of piece, it's one that would definitely sort of sit on, I think I call it probably stack three on my desk, which is the one that no one is allowed to touch. They always have to sort of remain. Occasionally things pull out of them, but the ones you always want to reach over for and reference. Charlotte, what do you you having sort of a plow through it there? What do you think?
I think it's quite genius how they've used the text pages in a matter paper and the photography on sort of glossy paper. Mm. I think it looks really comprehensive, and I also think it looks really sort of enticing and interesting to read. Normally when you're dealing with this sort of amount of information on a sort of index base, it can be quite hard to make it really enticing, but I think this looks great.
John, I wanted to ask you, when you know, when you get into the office on a Monday, or you sit down for a story meeting and you're plotting what you're going to be doing for the next issue, what are you seeing now in terms of whether it's paper stocks, whether it's, you know, use of infographics? Would you say there's sort of, you know, three or four, you know, main trends that are on the horizon right now? And just, we haven't sort of put you in the spot today, just to put you on the spot. But you're probably getting a view of things ahead of other people. You're talking to people in studios all over the world. And I'm wondering where you see things, you know, might be moving as we look across, you know, the newsstand over the next year or so?
Well, I think there are a lot of trends that are moving in almost opposite directions, because there's some very exciting things happening in the digital sphere to do with digital displays in big spaces and digital art that kind of crosses over into design, because it's often made for brands and such like. And, of course, that's great to cover in a magazine, because you're showing big 3D images of buildings and public spaces, but on the other hand, what we're talking about right now is a trend. I think magazines themselves have become almost a separate theme, and you meet people who, I mean, it's not the view I share, but they're almost into magazines regardless of the content. You know, it's actually a kind of excitement of you know, the thrill of publishing and seeing the story of little publishing companies making their own thing in all different corners of life.
So, because a little earlier you talked about this golden age. So is it an obsession with physical form, would you say? Because when you talk about, you know, people can almost divorce themselves from the content.
Well, I think the form is a very good way of explaining who you are. If you do a blog, as the one of the people we heard earlier on says, as the editor of the Germans said, you don't quite make a stamp on your audience in the same way.
And it's like you never go to a good launch party for a website.
Was that great scene in The Social Network, isn't it, where you know, Zuckerberg's business partner is saying, hey, when are we going to launch? And he says, we just have.
Yeah, exactly.
Having said that, I was invited to a Facebook party the other day, but
how was it?
Couldn't make it.
Okay, well, there you go. Enough said. So when you obviously, I would imagine that there are a number of applications landing on your desk, and whether they're fashion graduates or photo assistants who want to move into this world. What does the talent pool look like? Would you say there's just as much interest as when you sort of, you know, ventured through the doors to work on Acne Paper, in terms of just talent and people saying, no, I really want to work on a magazine. I don't want to be doing my own blog in my bedroom anymore. How do you see it at the moment?
I think we are sort of seeing an avalanche in interest in contributing to the magazine, which is obviously absolutely fantastic and something that we enjoy very, very much. The nature of the magazine, since we have the different themes, and also because we're quite distinct in our editorial voice and how we choose what goes into the magazine, it is quite hard to sort of choose from the people that actually come in through the door. Also, since we're only biannual, it takes quite a bit of time. We have a lot of photographers coming in who wants to shoot for us, and well, this doesn't really fit with the theme, so let's speak in a year's time.
Right. Yes, it gives you a good out clause, doesn't it?
What I'd say is that I get an avalanche of story proposals from young writers, and there are now more and more graduate programs for people who want to write about design.
Right.
But I would say a majority of them want to write about the past. They want to write about design history. And, of course, there are endless numbers of great stories from the history of design, but I'd quite like a few writers to write about now and the future.
I was also going to say, it must be a golden era as well, maybe, for commissioning editors too, because, you know, we've been through, is it a decade, half a decade, I don't know how long it is, of blog culture where people are doing things for free. So there's the other side, I would imagine, for lots of people, that there are many who would like to just, you know, get their words out on the printed page, which is good if you're an entrepreneurial editor. You can say, look, hey, it's we're not doing a dollar a word, we're doing a dollar for the whole story.
I think there is, there are some great writers out there who would love to be on the printed page. There is sometimes slight rabbit in the headlights effect as well, where the idea that they're doing their big piece for I actually sort of freezes them into inaction for a while. But fortunately, there's always enough great writers out there that we can find material. But I'd be quite interested in a few new writers writing about what's happening right now.
Right. And I want to come back to that because I don't want to run out of time, because I really want to discuss another interesting format, which is just, it's sort of, you know, it's nipping at your elbow over there. but just to set it up for us, what are we looking at?
Well, I brought the October 2012 edition of The Occupied Times of London. Mm. And this is produced by Occupy UK, and it's a design group within the whole Occupy movement who have really made a very strong attempt to produce a really well-designed, well-edited broadsheet paper that represents the political views of the Occupy movement. And it's quite a broad church of political views within Occupy. But as well as the kind of articles you'd expect about squatting and about the about Wall Street, you've also got a rather jokey horoscope at the back.
Right.
And even a crossword, rather unconventional crossword.
No, it's really something, and it has sort of, you know, shades. When you talk about documenting the past, you feel that this could have been a protest paper, very much from Europe in the 1930s, and I mean even typographically,
it would have taken them months to get something out. As
I was going to say, nevertheless, a very. It's a really ambitious, impressive piece.
I was at Typo London, annual conference last weekend,
yeah.
And Tsotsis Rallis, who's the Greek art director behind Occupied Times, gave a very eloquent
just the art director, not the editor.
I think there's quite a big editorial board. But
yeah, it looks Tsotsis like it's actually for such a small journal. It was quite a big masthead, as you said. There's certainly not just one school of political thought in the Occupy movement.
But he was he's very good in explaining. There's a very strong grid, as you can see. And they also use a custom display typeface designed by Jonathan Barnbrook, especially for the paper. And this is the 18th issue, so good luck to them. I think it's an impressive piece of print publication.
Impressions, Charlotte?
I think it's amazing that dealing with such a sort of heavyweight subject, that they don't seem to be taking themselves too seriously.
No.
With the horoscope and in the back.
I bet you should read out the horoscope to explain to our readers they're not. It's not Sagittarius and Aries.
Do you have a favourite?
I didn't get through the horoscope.
The champagne socialist, isn't it?
The champagne socialist, politicians, champagne socialist. After finding the energy to make some global noise, having bought a very fetching cast iron casserole dish from the local Waitrose, you may feel like returning to silence and hibernation in the cold months ahead. But let not passivity or ineffectual resistance define your political efforts this season, and consider branching out. Remember, as you bash a racket in yet another empty financial district, fulfillment lies not in a strongly worded letter.
There you go. Now, just before we go, the very people that I'm sure they're going after. I brought in field sports.
Just a magnificent segue.
It is the shooting and fishing quarterly. Partridges, greys, and red legs, salmon, autumnal magic, pheasants. Your choice of gun.
Your choice of gun could be a headline in a radical paper.
Well,
it
could as well, but I only brought this in because it's obviously very different from everything that we're looking at. But here is a classic commercial title which has to apply its craft also every month and talking about various pleasures of.
You're really wrong-footed me here, Tyler, because I've just never seen this magazine before in my life. No one's ever sent me a sample copy.
There you go. Now I'm thinking that there is an upcoming theme, for the eye to jump into.
I do remember once talking to the guy who did the photographs for the front of Country Life about the difficulty of making the jump to digital, because he had to do such a sort of a huge picture of a country estate.
Could you imagine?
And there came a time when everyone involved was satisfied that digital could do the job.
No, and it's I think what's interesting about it as well is that seems rather calm. We had someone quite earlier on talking about if you go up to Queensland in Australia, they have something like, you know, 7 or 8 magazines, you know, just devoted to hunting pigs every weekend. So
well, I think the fishing titles, that's one of the biggest sectors in the magazine industry.
No, it is. We're going to have to leave it there. You can jump into field sports all you like, both of you, if you want. Certainly the weather for it today. Our guests around the table have been Charlotte Ray of Acne Paper and John Walters from The Eye. Our producers were Don Trump, David Michon, Adrian Craddock, quite a bevy of people putting this program together. And our studio manager today was Toby Hammond. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us into info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday. We're going to be joined by Mario Garcia and our very own Richard Spencer Powell, our creative director. And I'm sure we'll be tucking into a variety of topics as we've got Mr. Garcia in studio. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com and, of course, iTunes. That's all from me, Tyler Brulé. Goodbye.